And so we need to go back to a three-year budgeting cycle where we don't make big changes between the M2S and the budget day.
The 2025 National Budget Review will go down as one of the most dramatic in recent history. As we were all waiting for the budget speech on 19th of February, with minutes to spare, we were told, not today, come back in 3 weeks. Cabinet had more to discuss. If ever there was a signal that the political landscape had shifted, that the old ways of doing things were over, this was it. The reason? That. More specifically, a proposed 2 percentage point increase in South Africa's VAT rate to fund new expenditure items and keep fiscal consolidation on track. By the time the postponement was announced, the media had already hinted at what was coming. Fast forward 3 weeks, after intense internal debates within the GNU and rampant speculation from the outside, the 2025 budget speech was finally delivered last Wednesday. To summarize, the debt path remains intact, despite a lower and more gradual VAT increase. To make the numbers work, there are tweaks at the edges, minor personal income and excise tax adjustments, and some spending pullbacks. But this budget saga is about more than just numbers. It lays bare the complexities of South Africa's shifting political landscape and the deep fiscal constraints we face. Debt to GDP has climbed to 75%, up from just 40% in 2012. GDP per capita is on a downward trend. Spending pressures are mounting. Tax revenue is struggling to keep up. Beyond our domestic challenges, global uncertainty looms, especially with US President Trump suddenly putting South Africa in the spotlight. So, how did we get here? Why is government debt such a big issue? Are we happy now? Should we be? What path are we on? Let's dive in. Hello and welcome to URSA's podcast series. I'm Margot G, and today's podcast is special for two reasons. Firstly, it will be co-hosted by URSA's Executive Director, Fashir Fenter, who has extensive experience in the fiscal policy space. And secondly, we will be delving into the first budget speech delivered by the Government of National Unity. Welcome, Fashir. It's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thanks, Margot. It's great to be here.
Thank you. Our guest today joining us is Dr. Roy Hovman, head of the Mpumelelo Economic Growth Lab at the Bureau of Economic Research. In addition to publishing several working papers in our working paper series and presenting at our SAMNet workshops, Roy has lectured macroeconomics, featured in the media, and also written his own book on how to fix or reboot South Africa. Definitely interested in reading that one. Welcome to our podcast. It is a pleasure to have you on our show.
Thank you very much, Margot, and thank you very much, Fashir, for having me. I'm looking forward to the discussion.
Thank you. So before we get into the discussion, Roy, we would like to get a little bit more personal. You have now been an economist for more than 20 years. Can you give us some background on your professional journey? Where did you study? Why did you decide economics? And what are some of the career highlights that you can share with us?
Yeah, thanks very much. I actually started wanting to become a chartered accountant and started my Bachelor's of Accounting degree at Stellenbosch University. And then halfway through my degree, I discovered the subject called economics. And I remember a discussion with my father about really liking the subject and wanting to change. And we had a very awkward conversation. But then he supported me. He's also an economist, essentially. And then I changed to economics and then went on. First job was teaching economics at Stellenbosch, and then I was very lucky to be offered a job with National Treasury, a very long time ago, and I started my career there, and then it gradually went up the system. I've also done some consulting along the way, consulted to Eskom and SANRAL, and enjoy that just as much as the Treasury.
Roy, when did you finish your PhD?
So I did my PhD. I set myself a goal of finishing it before I turned 40, and I actually had my defense on my 39th birthday. And so I finished my PhD in 2018.
And who was it under? Who was your supervisor?
Two supervisors. One was Stan Duplessis and the other one was Johan Faurie. And at the time I was working on something called the Resolution Framework, which is how do we fix banks that fail? And I didn't know very much about the topic, and it was a very new topic at the time. So I actually did my PhD on a history of banking crises in South Africa.
Oh, awesome. Okay. Cool.
Very interesting, and I think inspirational for a lot, because a lot of the time we're told that we can only register for a PhD if you're under a certain age. So that's lovely to know.
I would really recommend, I know a number of people that actually do it later in life. It's both easier and more difficult, but it's actually much more interesting, I think, because you have a much better sense of what you really want to find out about.
Yes, yes. Understanding the passions. And I think one of your passions is definitely understanding the budget and fiscal policy. So before we get into this year's budget, I would like us to talk a little bit more about how we got into the current fiscal challenges that we find ourselves in. As we mentioned in the introduction, South Africa's debt to GDP ratio is at 75%, nearly triple what it was in 2007. As a result, we spend 22 cents of every rand of tax revenue on interest payments to lenders, and we are paying more on servicing debt than we are on education, health, and social protection. What happened? How did we get here? If someone had to forecast our trajectory in the 2000s, would this have been considered a plausible scenario?
It depends when in the 2000s. So I think the big thing that happened was obviously the global financial crisis in 2008, which I think changed the economic trajectory of many countries, including this one. In my opinion, we responded incorrectly to the global financial crisis and chose to stimulate the economy by raising particularly government wages. And so there is a great graph showing the jump in government wages between 2008, 2009, and 2010, which really structurally increased spending. We have learned subsequently that if you want to do counter-cyclical fiscal policy, you must do counter-cyclical fiscal policy, which means you must use tools that you can take away. And what we really did was we put in place tools that you can't take away, because you can't cut government wages after you've raised them. And so that structurally caused a significant deterioration, in my opinion, in the fiscal framework forever. And then we continued. And as theory would tell you, that the consequence was that the Treasury raised taxes on a number of occasions through bracket creep, essentially, and then even raised VAT once in 2018, all to try and fix the fiscal position. But as we argue in our URSA note, and I think URSA has done a lot of work on this topic, so you guys should summarize it for us, that fiscal multipliers are quite negative for taxes. So what that means is an increase in taxes tends to lead to lower economic growth. You could put it another way, which is that a 1 rand or 1% increase in a tax rate doesn't deliver you 1% more revenue. And that's just because obviously taxes are harm the economy. The Financial Mail has a very interesting article which highlights something from Andrew Donaldson, where he highlights that the consequence of the Treasury not increasing the brackets means that a lot of people at the lower end have been brought into the tax system, because there is a minimum at which you don't pay tax, which is about 91,000 rand. But if you don't adjust that number up and people's wages rise, then they basically come into the tax system. And so at the bottom end, you've seen lots of people coming into the tax system, and those are generally people that consume a lot. So when I say consume a lot, they consume a large percentage of their income is consumption. And so you actually start really harming the consumption side of the economy by bringing them into the tax net.
And it's obviously quite regressive.
Yes. Yeah, by definition.
So Roy, that wage adjustment that happened in 2010, 2011, was that essentially the occupation-specific dispensation structure that got put into place at that point? And was that then a specific reaction, a kind of a counter-cyclical fiscal reaction, or was it just kind of coincidental that it happened at the same time? Was it more politically driven, do you think?
A bit of both. So I think the politicians, obviously there was a change of government, which we can't ignore, which is that in 2009, Jacob Zuma was elected as president with the support of the unions. And so the political balance of forces in the ANC shifted towards the unions. So they had a lot more power. But then the argument was made that this was good from an economic perspective.
Okay.
But we know that theoretically that's not true, that actually raising government consumption spending, especially government wages, is generally inflationary. And that's what the textbook says, and that's, I think, what happened, is that we had a textbook wage price spiral. from then onwards.
Yeah, and really ever since then, it was essentially this kind of crowding out of investment spending over that same period. So as the consumption spending increased, there was obviously a rapid escalation of the debt level at that point, but there was also then a rapid deterioration in the amount of we were spending in infrastructure over that decade, essentially.
Yes, yeah, exactly. I mean, and then a lot of policies just simply weren't implemented, and that created this weird, like, nowhere land. So famously, one of the policies that wasn't implemented was the unbundling of Eskom, which was government policy. A lot of the thinking about how Eskom would be financed and how it would make money was all predicated on this idea that Eskom would unbundle and become a standalone entity, blah, 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 and none of that ever happened. So these huge new contingent liabilities arose, like Eskom and Transnet and Danel, and yeah.
Roy, you mentioned how new liabilities have arisen, and we've heard some commentators push back about the idea that our debt levels are a big problem. Some of them have even warned us in comparison to what's happened in South America. After all, many other countries borrow much more than we do. They will cite examples such as Japan, who is at 250%, Singapore at 176%. How do you respond to this argument?
Yeah, we've actually got a forthcoming BER paper, which would have been out by now if it hadn't been for the budget, but yes, we've got a forthcoming BER paper looking at debt definitions and just making the point that actually, by some definitions, South Africa's debt level is even higher, because you have to think about how you count in contingent liabilities. So you might argue that Eskom is actually part of the overall debt levels. So that's one thing, if you do a like-for-like comparison, and in the paper we're going to do it, we have done a like-for-like comparison of South Africa versus other countries, and we're actually higher than we thought, because it's about what you count into your debt levels. That aside, it's just like you or me, right? It's just a normal, you know, sometimes fiscal policy is just like normal household policy, which is maybe where I disagree with many other economists, but that it matters not how much debt you have, it matters how much you pay in interest on your debt.
Yeah.
And as a share of how much income we earn, so debt repayments to revenue, it's very high. And as a share of spending, debt repayments are very high. It's now the second highest, largest component after learning, which is education. That is a consequence of us having very high borrowing rates. So the rate at which we borrow is very high. So, the reason why Japan can survive at such high levels is because they have low interest rates. It's not really related to the quantum of debt. It's related to the repayments of that debt.
Okay, and just for expanding on that idea, those interest rates are essentially determined by the country as an investment destination and the risks involved in investing in that country. It would very much be the thing that determines those interest rates.
Yeah, so Lesetse Ganyogo, the governor, has a really good way of explaining this, and he does it much better than I could ever do it, which he says the Reserve Bank sets the short-term rate, that's the overnight rate, and the Treasury and the government sets the long-term rate.
Okay.
Because the short-term rate is how much the banks borrow at overnight from the Reserve Bank. The long-term rate reflects, like you say, it's this, you know, it's the term premium. And I think Ursa has a number of papers on this, mostly written by Dan Steenkamp, but there are a lot of term premium papers which highlight the fact that long-term rates are determined by sovereign risk, the structure of debt, and inflation expectations. And so what happens is you get a very steep yield curve, which means that the yield curve is low at the short term and long in the long run. And what that means is that investors regard us as a very risky place to lend money to. And the reason why they regard us very risky is because we have very high... So it becomes a vicious cycle. We have very high debt levels, so they regard us as very...
But kind of fiscal credibility becomes a big deal there, right? In terms of doing what you say you're going to do as a national treasury or as a budget office or finance ministry.
Yeah. Credibility is very important. So doing what you say you're going to do is a very important part of the story. You know, this old concept of in economics called time inconsistency, which we often use for monetary policy, actually comes originally from fiscal policy. It doesn't come from monetary policy. It was actually invented to describe fiscal policy, something that we argue in an Ursa working paper. But also Chris Leuwald and I think Konstantin Makarlov have a paper on time inconsistency. And this is saying that the fiscus is basically time inconsistent, which means that what they say they're going to do, they don't do. They cheat in the future. And we've seen that actually. We did a Business Day article recently showing actually how much they cheat just between MTBS and Budget Day.
Yes. Yeah, we're certainly going to talk about that article specifically, you guys talking about a dull budget and all, I think that's an interesting idea and specifically kind of focused on this kind of risk idea, right, that we're talking about now. Also, just for people listening, so we'll include all these papers that Roy is citing on the landing page, so you'll be able to get access to them.
Yeah, I think that definitely opens up the next question in terms of fiscal credibility and what has happened, what has transpired in the past couple of weeks. Getting to the 2025 budget review, were you surprised at how this transpired and how it ended up?
I was surprised. And I mean, I think that's great credit, you know, huge credit to the Treasury that no one told me. So good for them. I was, I heard it over rumors from Bloomberg, and it subsequently come out that that was a leak from Cabinet, not from the Treasury. And so I'm very proud of the Treasury that they, of all the things we spoke about in the weeks before Budget Day, they never mentioned this to me. So I was quite surprised that they had the guts to do it, and that it was, you know, politically obviously just not feasible. So I think the politicians just said no.
So were you, I mean, in terms of subsequently after the 2% shock that wasn't to be, the kind of compromised or a kind of middle ground position that he eventually took, was that essentially what you were expecting?
No, we still don't know. So, I mean, we've just had a BR webcast now. I mean, it's not clear that there is an agreement to 4.5 percentage point increase in VAT, I think, politically, as we sit here on the 17th of March. That might come to light tomorrow. There is the start of the parliamentary process tomorrow. Then I think we'll get better sense from the DA and the other members of the GNU if they support a VAT increase. And then if they don't, I think we'll have to have a third budget.
Wow.
And also kind of what's interesting around this type of uncertainty in terms of whether it's VAT or not VAT or whatever the case is eventually. I mean, I'm not really one to really follow markets, but it does seem that the market's kind of just happy that the fiscal consolidation is still a high priority, regardless nearly of how that's achieved from the market's point of view, the capital market's point of view.
And interesting enough, depends on which economist you talk to. If you talk to a markets economist, they were very happy with the budget. If you talk to an economist that follows retail, they're very unhappy with the budget because the increase in VAT will hurt the consumer. But the markets economists are quite pleased. The issuance levels are unchanged, broadly speaking. I think that's kind of why the market is kind of quite happy at the moment, is that any outcome is probably not going to affect borrowing. Whatever happens, it's probably going to come out better for borrowing. The same for borrowing.
Okay, so if you think a little bit longer term, though, it will have likely an inflationary impact, right? I mean, intuitively, that feels right to me. In terms of the broader kind of monetary discussion around the lowering of the target, we don't have to get too deep into it now, but it just does feel like this is kind of really kind of working up against that longer term plan that we might or might not have. What do you think this does for monetary policy?
Oh, I mean, I think it does make, so in one of our papers, Hilton and I talk about the games between monetary and fiscal policy, and Hilton's doing some other work, I think it's also coming out as an ERSA working paper, if I'm not mistaken, with Sean Tablanche, about monetary fiscal coordination, and really, it's just game theory. I like to think of it as old fashioned prisoner's dilemma, where the best outcome is that the Treasury and the Reserve Bank coordinate, and that requires a fiscal path that is a strong fiscal consolidation that the Reserve Bank believes. Then they can lower interest rates because obviously fiscal consolidation is disinflationary for the economy. So then they start lowering rates, which actually helps the Treasury indirectly. If they don't believe that, then you get the other Nash equilibrium, which is two parties that don't agree.
Okay.
And then the outcome is actually the Reserve Bank raises rates or keeps rates up. So, yeah, you can think there's a very nice Alan Blinder paper on this, actually, which basically just, you know, explains it all as a prisoner's dilemma. And I think that's in one of Hilton's paper or our paper.
But, I mean, what I'm also just referring to is nearly the direct impact of VAT on prices.
Oh, yes.
Right. Obviously, consolidation as a whole and over the medium term has kind of the disinflationary impact if it's kind of spending-sided. And if it's income tax sided, let's say. But if it is consumption based, the tax, that has an inflationary impact. That does make the job of monetary policy considerably harder, right?
Absolutely, because I mean, we did some modeling, and we actually put it out to clients of a 2 percentage point increase in VAT, and it's not rocket science. I mean, it's not like you have to run a, we have a big model that's very similar to the Treasury's model and the Reserve Bank's model, but it's not rocket science.
Okay.
The consequence is that prices go up, right? How hard is this? And that's fine. So you have a spike in inflation, that's fine. To what extent the Reserve Bank can deal with the second round effects? If those prices cause a price spiral, then they must respond and raise rates to dampen the overall economy. But if they feel that monetary policy is credible, then they can kind of look through it and call it a transitory shock. But knowing the bank, they will probably not want to take the risk of a transitory shock to prices. And they'll probably keep rates tighter for longer just to be sure that there's no second round effect on the VAT rate. So in actual fact, the consequence is double on the economy. This is what our modeling suggests, because both the increase in VAT is bad for consumption and it's inflationary. And it's seen by the bank as not transitory, so they actually respond. That makes sense.
Okay, so yeah, you speak about the impacts of the multiplier effect of how it becomes inflationary and how that primarily impacts the poor consumers. And it reminds me of a paper you wrote a little while ago. It was published in our ISA series on the Universal Basic Income Grant.
You actually read my paper? Oh, my God.
Not only did I read the paper, but I had to summarize part of it, so I had to get my head around some of it.
Tried. Thank you. Someone tried. I'll tell Hilton someone read the paper.
Yeah, but that was also a discussion paper. It's a nice paper to read because it's really not that academic language type paper, I feel.
Because actually what happens is that the people that understand the stuff understand the stuff. It's very hard. Once you're into heterogeneous agent neo-Keynesian models, people are like, woo. I mean, I just fall asleep. Hilton's in charge.
Yeah.
Okay, so you mentioned how this VAT increase also has second-round inflationary impacts, which also impact the poor consumers most. In that paper about funding options for a universal basic income grant, you concluded that VAT would be the most efficient option. What did you mean by that? And does it apply to the context of this current VAT increase? And does efficient necessarily mean it is best or even good?
Yes, absolutely. It's to strongly stick to what we found. And the National Treasury strongly agreed with us. And in actual fact, much of what they said, the minister said, was that the only way to pay for an extension of the SOD is actually to increase, because that's one of the items that has to be funded in this budget, and has said a number of times that VAT is the most efficient way of doing it. I'm not sure if he read my paper. I will say, though, that the paper reflects the Treasury consensus, the internal Treasury consensus, and I think the academic and orthodox consensus, which is that a basic income grant can be funded by increase in VAT. This is the technical answer. It's not the political answer, which is that you have to then ask yourself, is the country prepared to have an increase in VAT for a basic income grant? And as we've seen, it's not that straightforward, because these are kind of, this is now where we're going into political economy, and I'm not really the political economist, I'm more of just a technical economist. But if I were asked by the minister, I want to increase spending by what was in the first budget, 108 billion in one financial year, and in the second budget was 102 billion in one financial year, I would answer exactly what National Treasury said, and I would say exactly the same thing, that the best way of paying for it is an increase in VAT. And I stick to that view, and the reason for that is because it's the least distortionary across the system. You know, the one thing about VAT is that it's paid by everyone. So I joked the other day that VAT is paid from roughly conception when you are conceived, because everything that your mother eats is usually VAT-able, except for a few items, but most people will consume, baby formula isn't VAT-able, thank God, but most other things that your mother will eat, chicken, for example, is VAT-able. So, and then after you die, if you use an estate, a lawyer to deal with your will, he will charge VAT. Then if you have a plot in a cemetery, you'll be charged VAT. So basically VAT just applies to you from before you're born to after you're dead. And it applies to everyone. Every single South African pays VAT. So it's the broadest base system that we have. And so it doesn't have very many distortions. And so increasing it is broad-based. It is, however, regressive. in my opinion, and I know I disagree with some National Treasury colleagues on this, and the reason why it's regressive is because the poor pay a larger share of their income to consumer goods compared to the rich, and so if you raise VAT by 1 percentage point, it's pretty much every single thing that they buy. Their effective tax rate goes up by that amount, but you probably have money in like a retirement annuity and you put savings away and whatever, so you probably don't consume every single cent you get back. So it is regressive, I think. But these are political questions.
What is the counter argument to say VAT is regressive? I mean, what would people say in response to what you just said? Can you articulate it?
The counter argument the Treasury makes quite often is that, and they have a point, is that if you look at the distribution of where VAT comes from, the top end of the spectrum pays the most VAT by a long shot. And that's just because we have a very unequal economy, and so huge amounts of consumption at the top end. People buying cappuccinos and lattes and croissants and stuff. But at the low end, people don't have much money. But that doesn't take into account the fact that actually at the top end, a lot of people are saving.
Yeah, but also I'm not 100% sure that is the... When someone talks about the regressivity or progressivity of a tax system, they're talking about the percentage of someone's revenue being paid over as tax. So if you have, yes, as a proportion of total VAT paid, it kind of sits on the richer side, but because you have this very unequal distribution of income proportional to the income, it's obviously a much higher proportion of their income being spent on it in the way that you defined it in your argument.
Yeah. And I think, so there are arguments why you should use personal income tax to pay for grants, because it's not regressive at all.
Okay.
But it is then distortionary, because personal, as in Chris Axelson's own paper, I think correctly finds, he does a very careful, clever job of how he finds it, but I don't think you need to be that clever. You just look at the how much money we've raised from the top end.
Yeah.
And we've raised less from the top end than we did before. And, it's not hard to know why. I mean, people are creating companies and doing weird and wonderful stuff with the consequence that they just don't pay that much in personal income tax.
I mean, the whole debate, I suppose, is just essentially around if you're going to implement some type of tax revenue increasing policy, you have kind of a political decision to make, which is a trade-off between efficiency and equity, where your small amount over a bunch of people is more efficient but less equitable, while the income and the capital type taxes are way more distortionary on the markets, but they have a much more progressive kind of outcome to them.
Yes, exactly. And I think that is a political question. It's not an economic question. I mean, I can tell you what the economics is, but that's really what why we have politicians. We have political parties that have different views on these things.
So it reminds 100%. Me of a quote I once heard by an American economist, and he said, the first law of economics is that of scarcity, and the first law of politics is to ignore the first law of economics.
So that's brilliant.
I can find out who said it, but I'm sure if you Google it. Anyway, I'll never forget that. It made me laugh.
Sorry, Margaret, I just want to do one more follow-up. I mean, when we're talking about kind of VAT being the best option, we are also talking about in a world where VAT or a tax increase is necessary, right? So if you want to create fiscal space, there's debt, which is kind of a no-go zone, at least in terms of the way we're talking about it. There's revenue, so on the tax side, but there's the expenditure side, really, which is about kind of reprioritization and wasteful expenditure. I mean, I know that in a country where severe consolidation is required, that is kind of on a very unsustainable jet trajectory, it's very seldom that they kind of get away with it without kind of some tax increases over the period. I know even one of the biggest success stories of the 2010s was Jamaica, who halved their debt to GDP ratio over a 10-year period, but a big part of it was done through quite a substantial, I think they have sales tax increase. But in our current situation, should we be thinking a little bit more on the expenditure side at this point before these taxes start coming in?
Yeah. I mean, all your work on, all Earth's work on fiscal multipliers points completely in the same direction as the international literature, which is that expenditure multipliers, if you want to achieve fiscal consolidation, the only way you can do this is expenditure cuts. That's the right way of doing it. Yeah. So you kind of like in a second best world where you're now debating what tax to raise. I think then you're in trouble. Then you're in trouble. And we are in trouble. Oh, and actually just in economic growth, which is why I have a growth lab and I don't really care about fiscal policy.
Well, we just spoke about the fact that they're connected, right? Yes, at least in the long term.
So in addition to having read your paper that we mentioned, I also read your article that you did with Claire Bissaker in the Business Day. And also having spoken about how expenditure cuts are important and time inconsistency is a fiscal policy notion, what do you mean in your article when you talk about the importance of bringing back the dull budget? Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Make the budget dull again. Yes. So,
love it.
The idea really is that budgets were very dull back in the day because we had a very clear empty process, and the way it worked was that the MTS would really put down the fiscal framework, and then that was an outcome of a whole bunch of negotiations inside government, and then you would come out with the three-year fiscal framework, and then basically what would happen is that then the budget day would just be a sort of putting that into effect. And so budget day was very dull, so we'd always make it more fancy with like aloes and all this other stuff. But the market just, I mean, the last time VAT was increased by one percentage point, I mean, by the time it happened, everybody knew it was going to happen. There was not even a whisper of concern. The Parliament was very unhappy and complained a lot, but the ANC knew it was coming, the markets knew it was coming, taxpayers knew it was coming. I think we need to go back to that, and so we need to go back to a three-year budgeting cycle where we don't make big changes between the MTVS and the budget day. And what I did there is I drew a little graph about the difference between the first year of the MTF, so the first year of the budget compared to the MTVS forecast, compare them between MTVS and budget day, and show that there were, on average, we'd added about 54 billion in between MTVS day and budget day to spending, which now we know what that means in real English, which is 2 percentage points in VAT. We've done that for the last, out of the last, since 2021, we've done that 4 out of 5 times. And you would say, well, why haven't we raised VAT before? Well, we haven't. What we've done is just borrowed more. So we've borrowed that extra 50. Yeah, so we're kind of in trouble. And we're not following the principle of the three-year budgeting frame.
So, I mean, the big spending items, right, that caused the, let's say, the 52 between September last year and, well, I suppose it eventually ended up being March this year, not February, was kind of the public sector wage agreement, which was apparently higher than they expected, social protection, ECD, and then some infrastructure spending. It does feel a little strange to say those things were surprising, right?
It does, and many of those things the Treasury kind of knew about, but was potentially just hoping they would go away. Best way of putting it. Particularly, I mean, you've done a lot of work on this at a provincial level. The provinces have been in trouble for quite a while. And that penny finally dropped at the Treasury, that the provinces have been in trouble for quite a while. So, you know, that I think was the response, that the Treasury finally accepted that. And then, you know, made, you're probably better talking this than me, actually, made adjustments to spending to deal with the wage pressures and the essentially unfunded mandates stuff.
So it was the wage increase, but it was also, I mean, they're also essentially bringing back a bunch of, especially kind of frontline education and healthcare workers. I'm not sure exactly how it's rehiring or opening posts again, which is obviously a very, very good thing. But in the context of kind of escalating wages per person, that kind of creates a situation of a unsustainable pathway of wage increases, a total wage bill of the government, which is really the big problem here. And maybe just for everyone's benefit, I mean, the one thing that provinces struggle with, I mean, struggle with is the wrong word, but they don't really have a whole lot of revenue generating ability themselves. So they are funded through the provincial equitable share formula, which is national taking a portion of total nationally collected revenue and distributing it across the provinces according to a formula that's based on a bunch of criteria. So the provinces are spending an enormous, very high percentage of our total budget, but have very little influence on how much revenue they actually have to spend. So it's completely up to the Treasury in terms of what that happens, and that's health and education, obviously the thing that gets impacted the most by that.
Yes, you should maybe write a paper on integrated fiscal, which I mean, yeah, is very helpful, because I think a lot of people don't quite understand how much provinces spend and how important that is.
Yeah. So, yeah, the PES is very, very interesting, especially because it doesn't necessarily incentivize economic progress. But we can talk about that as well at some point.
Yeah, and I think from my perspective, this is why I find the fiscal multiplier so interesting, because it's about the effectiveness of how the funds are being spent. But perhaps we should do a podcast on that down the line. I think for now it's important to remember that we are in a difficult position and we have relatively few options, as we've mentioned. But Roy, what would you have liked to have seen more of in the budget? And how optimistic are you about South Africa's fiscal policy going forward?
Oh, like, I'm remarkably optimistic. I mean, which is weird. I'm remarkably optimistic because, you know, I think we've managed to elect a GNU that's fiscally quite conservative. And that is good. You know, big items, I think, like Fashir said, the really big elephant in the room is, and as we started on the call, you know, you asked, how did we get into this mess? I said it was government wages, and Fashir was quite right that we just keep on with that sin, because we've just raised wages again by more than inflation. Like, I'm not sure if the GNU on average is going to let that happen again. And that is good. I don't think the GNU is going to put up with government waste, which is good. So I think it's very complicated at the moment, but it's long term very positive.
That's cool.
And I'm very pleased that, you know, I think it's very cool. I was talking to, actually, because we just had this BR call, and I think every single we had Michael and Andrew and Estienne Karlitz and Matthew all on the call, and I think the general consensus is actually good for democracy that we now actually have a democratic process by which we decide to spend our money. And it's not a populist government. It's not a populist parliament. Parliament will decide if they want VAT or not.
No.
It's good, I think.
So just for those of you that don't know, what I was talking about, Michael Sachs, Andrew Donaldson, and Matthew Simmons, who are all three, and then Estienne Karlitz, who are actually all four, are ex-Treasury, National Treasury officials with long-standing civil servants in the fiscal policy space. Not anymore, but the kind of long-term fiscal policy experts in the country. That's good.
So before we shift our focus to closing off, Roy, you and Hilton Hollander, Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Cape Town, are currently working on a policy paper for IRSA looking at a new concept known as fiscal R-star. Can you elaborate on what that is and talk a little bit about what you and Hilton plan on doing?
Yes, so there is a well-established concept in monetary policy called R-star, which is a neutral rate of monetary policy. So that's the idea when monetary policy is being neutral, and lots of academic work on that. And there's been some really interesting work out from the IMF saying there's another concept called fiscal R star, which is the neutral rate for fiscal policy. We argued in our previous paper that you can calculate a debt stabilizing primary balance. You can take that formula and do it the other way around, and you can calculate a interest rate that is consistent with your fiscal policy stance. which is a really elegant thought, because it kind of tells you exactly what I was telling earlier, which is like, you know, people that lend money to you think about whether or not you're going to repay it and your debt thing. So there's kind of a market clearing interest rate for fiscal policy, which I think is a really intuitively nice idea. And then you can compare the two, right? You can take monetary R-star and you can compare it to fiscal R-star, and you can go, oh wait, monetary R-star is higher than fiscal R-star. What does that mean? Or the other way around, or they're the same. And yeah, I think it's going to be a really interesting paper. I think it's very nice of Ursa to support us on this one. And then we'll hopefully have a workshop for you guys in June. Cool.
Yeah, maybe an open seminar in around September-ish.
Open seminar, October.
Yes. And so it's essentially also kind of looking at the further fiscal R-star and monetary policy R-star is apart, the kind of greater the tension is between the two, monetary and fiscal policy. And there's kind of certain reactions that you would want from either institution, depending on how far they are apart at any one point. So Roy and them are also going to look at what that difference has been over time, and also see in over time how the Ministry of Finance and the Reserve Bank has reacted, even though the concept might have been underlying, because it's obviously they weren't working out fiscal R-star at that point. So it's a nice additional mechanism to really understand policy in the macro space.
Okay. Look forward to that. And closing question then for you, Roy. Is there anything else you would like to add? It's been a pleasure having you on our show.
No. I think I need a holiday after this budget.
Thank you, Roy. It's really been a pleasure having the opportunity to speak to you. And we're really grateful that you could also give us some of your time with all that has been going on. Thank you so much. And also a big thank you to Pusher for joining us. Thank you also for sharing your time today. It's been great having you with us. And of course, a big thank you to our listeners. And should you be interested in any of the content related to this podcast, as Pusher mentioned, you can find it on the podcast landing page on the Ursa website. Thank you so much for listening so far. And for any more updates, please subscribe to our social media platforms. From your hosts, Margot G and Fisher Fenter from the Ursa podcast series, thank you. Until next time.